Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. When it's time for a new credit card, the best ones do way more than just buy stuff. And that's why U.S. Bank offers credit cards that make every day more rewarding. Earn cash back, score points when you shop, dine out, travel, or binge watch, or get a low intro APR. U.S. Bank credit cards were designed to fit your lifestyle. So make every day more rewarding and check out usbank.com/credit card. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast. It is St. Patrick's Day here, and it is also the first day of the league new year. Mario, happy St. Patrick's Day. I see you're not wearing any green, so.
No.
If you went to my, grade school, you'd get pinched.
Yeah, you should be in fuller garb than this yourself, right? Like, I have an excuse. I'm not Irish, and I don't do the thing where I pretend to be Irish, so I don't have either reason to dress up that way. But you have this somewhat low-effort green shirt, but no hat, no gold jingling on your apparel. You're supposed to carry treasures, I think, but, and I don't see any.
If I'm carrying them around, people are going to triangulate me. They're going to hunt me down. They're going to steal my gold. So I got to keep that on the low.
They scream woo at you and raise their hands for a high five. But if you're like me, you're not actually doing a high five. You're setting them up for the treasure snatch.
See, precisely. So, you know, that's a smart way of playing it. I know that, this is a relatively low effort. I got just like a green shirt with the, what's it, the clover on it?
Shamrock?
Shamrock clover. I had a shamrock shake recently.
I am wearing a shirt of a band that's from Boston, and that is not Irish-themed in any way, but Boston's an Irish town, I understand.
I got to say, it would be really funny if you were wearing, like, a Dropkick Murphys shirt right now, but...
Oh, God, no. I hate those guys. But Converge is from Boston, I think, or something in Massachusetts anyway. It's all Ireland, okay. I think.
Massachusetts, the Ireland of America. But let's begin. We got a really busy week of news to unpack here. So the legal tampering period began on Monday morning. Gentlemen, start your tampering. Monday at noon Eastern, and then today, Wednesday, the league year officially got underway. So before we get into the signings that have happened, Mario, I want to get your opinion on the signings that haven't yet, and more specifically, why is the top end of the free agent receiver market as frigid as it currently is?
Well, I guess that it's so we basically got Will Fuller, Curtis Samuel, Kenny Galladay, Juju Smith-Schuster still available since Allen Robinson and Chris Godwin both got tagged. And maybe if those two would sign extensions and, you know, maybe if they hadn't been tagged, we would have had a market set already. But closest guess that I have is that Galladay, Fuller, Smith-Schuster's agents were kind of thinking, we're going to get something like what Robinson and Godwin are getting, or, you know, at least we need to know what they're getting before we know what we're demanding, kind of thing. So in the absence of that standard being set, these guys, these receivers that are still on the market, they, especially if you're a good one like Will Fuller and you know, Juju and them, you're not worried about not getting a job if you don't sign soon enough, you know, so they don't have any reason to really move. And the teams aren't going to offer in the meantime what they anticipate to be Godwin and Robinson type numbers. So there's kind of like that ambiguity, and who knows where the two respective sides are mapping out, where they think any of those markets are going to go. But until they're set, it's just kind of like no one's going to sell themselves short in negotiations because they don't want to look like a chump in, you know, 4 hours.
Right, exactly. Yeah, things can move so quickly. So I guess I just am surprised just because of, you know, how quality they are. I guess the lowering of the cap and, you know, how strapped certain teams are, it can all kind of play a role in this one particular thing being a little bit slow to get off the ground as far as the top end of the receiver market goes. And then, you know, you also have, you know, what's perceived to be a pretty deep receiver class coming in. Maybe people think that they can find their fix through the draft one way or the other. So either way, I am surprised that we're sitting here and some kind of lower level free agents are already looking at pretty nice deals or, you know, lower level receivers, even specifically looking at deals that we might not have been expecting while we're, you know, still kind of waiting on guys like you're saying, Will Fuller, Kenny Galladay, Curtis Samuel to ink. So we'll see what happens with them. And, you know, we'll check back in later this week on part two of our free agent frenzy, podcast and see if they've found a landing spot, just yet. But let's go ahead. Let's move on over kind of one of the more surprising developments, that one that I don't think a lot of people saw coming. And it's, you know, completely counter to how they've operated basically under this entire last 20, 25 or 23 years or whatever. The Patriots, not just a little bit splashy, but like being the like almost mid 2000s Washington football team level of splashy signings here. And I don't think a lot of people saw that coming, but what have you thought of that? And then specifically with the signings that they have made?
Yeah, well, it's not a great position that the Patriots started with. They obviously mismanaged a lot of things in the past few years, and those mistakes put them in a difficult position right now. And that difficult position is the choice of, do you want to spend a lot of money or do you want to know for a certainty that you're going to suck 2 years in a row? And I understand the criticism, the broader criticism of saying they spent too much. It's not good to spend this much in free agency. This is what losing teams do. And I understand that criticism, but to me at this point, it's kind of like a gibberish criticism. It's not meaningful now. You're criticizing past actions. If you want to criticize the past actions, do that, but you can't say the past actions are somehow the current ones. And you're not fixing the past actions by doing nothing now to try to fix them. So it kind of reminds me of the Stafford trade with the Rams, when people are like, oh my God, why would you trade so much for Matt Stafford? Don't you know it's bad to have cap penalties? Dead money's bad. Don't you know that? And it's like, yeah, they do know that. But they, in the Patriots case, it's like, we saw what happens when we go in with the kind of personnel that we had last year. It's just bad. It sucks. You can't play that way.
They were like the least watchable team. Like I enjoyed watching the Jaguars more than I enjoyed watching the Patriots last year.
Yeah, it's not good what they were last year, and given, you know, the off season as the only chance to fix any of that, you have to spend in free agency. You can resign to having the same bad team, or you can try to do something to change it. And yeah, it's more ideal to have a Jonnu Smith on like a rookie contract or something, but there's no way for them to assemble this personnel that they did through the draft. and they have the money to spend it, so who cares? It's not like this is egregious. I guess I personally don't really like the Kendrick Bourne signing that much, but no. Even so, it's not an egregiously expensive one. And we still don't even know the exact dollar figures for these things. We never figure out the exact dollar figures for these things for at least like a couple weeks. And even then, it's like we need over the cap and people like that to explain some of these esoteric contract mechanisms that they've got going on to make the money basically look different than what it actually is for all practical cap purposes. So if it turned out that Kendrick Bourne is playing like on a 2-year, $13 million deal, like who cares? Doesn't matter. Were they going to get something for saving that money? Do they have a big contract extension that they got to make right now? I don't see anything. It's like, so they could either spend that money on extensions for players who they don't really have a reason to right now, or they can go spend it on people like Jonnu Smith and Hunter Henry, which I think is like, I understand why people with those two fantasy investments are disappointed and why they might be thinking like, oh, damn you, Belichick. Hunter Henry should have gone to Jacksonville or something. But I don't think that New England's a worse spot for Hunter Henry than Jacksonville or the Chargers, because – or at least like not necessarily. It's not my first idea of what Hunter Henry should have done. But if they're running that old Gronk Aaron Hernandez offense, what are we even talking about? Obviously, they could use two tight ends like this if they're running that scheme. And obviously, they didn't run it last year because they didn't have the personnel to do it. So – If they're trying to build something that we've seen them already build before, and if they're getting good players at more or less reasonable market rates, I don't understand what the criticism is at that point. It's like I could maybe quibble where I'd go with a different player here or there, not so much a tight end, a receiver more so. But the idea that they needed to just not spend that money is ridiculous, and the idea that they should just not have competitive ambitions because they had a couple bad off seasons and mismanaged some things is also ridiculous. Like we already know that they could have done things better in the past. Just repeating that forever is not interesting.
No, it's not. And you know, the way that the market has obviously shaped out in the early part, like the Patriots once again look really smart, you know, taking advantage of a slow moving receiver market to get two receivers that apparently, you know, they find fits what they want to do offensively. I do have a question for you, but before we circle back to you know, what this new look two tight end type of base offense could look like. But, you know, you're so good with knowing the alignments and everything. How many slot snaps, especially if Julian Edelman comes back, can, you know, are there realistically going to be able to go around in this offense? Because, you know, you already have, I thought, a guy in Jacoby Myers who looked promising, like really one of the few, if only, bright spots in this passing game a year ago. You get Edelman back if he's healthy. You know, he's a year older. You can never really count on him to play a full 16 anymore. But, you know, you add Kendrick Bourne to that mix. Is he almost more like a depth addition, you know, kind of securing that fourth receiver spot? How does this all play out as far as like the receiver rotation looking?
Well, I don't know what they're planning to do exactly. Like, to me, it looks to me like Kendrick Bourne and Jacoby Myers are pretty redundant. And I thought, like you, that Jacoby Myers did a really good job, not just last year, but 2 years ago, too. And maybe there's something funny in his numbers. Like, maybe he's not quite as good, not as clean as his numbers are. But no one else was doing well at receiver on that team. And he wasn't just the best of a bad bunch. His numbers are strong by conventional standards last year. Like there's not like a bunch of touchdowns or whatever, but he was super efficient in an offense where no one else was. So I thought Myers fit like a certain function in the offense, which is to say, like, especially intermediate, maybe underneath kind of stuff. He can play inside or out, but you know, you're not really going downfield with Myers. So I like Aguilar's addition because that's, you know, he's not my favorite pick. I would have definitely rather paid up for Curtis Samuel or Will Fuller. But if we just need speed and we need someone who can play outside, like, yeah, Aguilar's pretty good. He's not bad. He's fast enough that the safeties have to run with him if he runs past them. And so you can imagine an alignment where Nelson Aguilar and Kendrick Bourne or Nelson Aguilar and Jacoby Myers can work together, because the safeties can't just jump on Myers or Bourne in that case, because Aguilar will run past them. But if Aguilar doesn't run past them, the safeties can crash down with impunity, because Bourne's not running away from anyone. And as much as I like Myers, he's not really the kind of guy who kills you on an over-aggressive blitz either. It's like maybe he gets a first down, but that's about the worst that's going to happen. When you have some real speed out there, you make the touchdown possibility very real. And the defense, no matter what the down and distance, they have to respect it. If they don't, you can get a touchdown on them pretty easily. So, or at least like a defensive pass interference call. So I just worry about the balance of having two slow guys like Myers, and not that he's truly slow, but Bourne is truly slow. Bourne's not a very good athlete. He's one of these guys who needs the field to kind of be small, and he needs everybody to kind of forget about him, and he can make these acrobatic plays. Like, he's crafty. He's good at being a wide receiver, even though he doesn't have all the tools to be the best wide receiver possible. But it's just not that helpful in the structure of an offense, in my opinion. Kendrick Bourne, to me, is the kind of guy you pick up because he's just an undrafted free agent out of Eastern Washington, you know? Like, that's when you get him in that case. You don't pay for him in free agency. But he's not a bad player. Like, he should ride the baseline of the offense. I just don't think he can dictate the baseline being higher. And so I do worry about Bourne, like, having much of a role if Myers is out there and if Aguilar is out there, because we need a two tight end base. Like, last year, Ryan Izzo, Devin Asiasi, and Dalton Keene combined for like not even 1,000 snaps, and we're going to need 1,500 between Henry and Jonnu Smith alone. So that's upwards of like 500 snaps that we're going to receivers, or I guess it could have been offensive linemen or something, but like there's a lot of snaps that they have to create for tight ends that weren't there last year. And you don't want Kendrick Bourne as your outside wide receiver in a two tight end base. You want some speed to offset the speed that you lose by foregoing a wide receiver in favor of a tight end.
Absolutely. So that's a good way of drawing it up as far as this new receiver grouping and personnel and usage could go. I guess my next question for you, I want to hear a little bit more about your thoughts on Aguilar, because I thought he was one of the best stories of last season.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was one of the guys that, you know, like, just like the famous Philadelphia news clip of the guy, just throwing Aguilar under the bus when he's talking about, like, catching people jumping out of a burning building or something. He's like, we actually caught him, unlike Aguilar. He's like, just throwing strays at Aguilar.
Yeah.
You know, kind of finds this renaissance in a place in Vegas that I don't think that Derek Carr really gets the moniker of being this guy that can be the one that makes a wide receiver. So for him to, you know, eat up almost 30% of the team's air yardage, do killer numbers on air yardage on a per snap basis, his average depth of target down like 15 yards down the field. That's really, really far. Of course, that's, you know, one of the bigger, you know, longer deep threats in the league. And he was killer on the long passes just in general. How much do we think that that's going to translate to this offense, especially if, you know, we have the two tight ends on the field? Is he going to be running like the same kind of just over the top guy that to keep the safeties honest type of thing, or what's going on there?
Well, Aguilar is not a true burner. Like, he's the fastest that they have, and he's better outside than he is inside, which was Philadelphia's main mistake, and it was the main reason that allowed Aguilar to break out last year. It's not that he I'm sure he had the yips a little bit in Philadelphia, but the main reason he did good for the Raiders is that they put him at the right position. They should have him playing outside and downfield because he's a slight guy. He's skinny, and he doesn't handle contact very well. But he's very elusive, and one thing, if you watch like his USC tape, it's pretty easy to see why the Eagles took him in the first round, because he's this guy who makes a lot of impressive runs in the open field, and he's really fast, but he's not like a sub-4.4, he's like a 4.41, which for how skinny he is more like just good enough than truly like an abundance of athleticism, because his case reminds me a lot of D.E. Westbrook, actually. Because D.D. Westbrook is this guy who's been playing in the slot for the Jaguars, and then this new coaching, Jay Gruden, came in last year and was like, wait a second, this guy sucks. Why are we playing him in the slot? Let's get him out of there. Put Keelan Cole, Chenault, anybody else. And I think that Jay Gruden, was reaching the same, like, disgust point with Aguilar, with Westbrook, that people did with Aguilar, where Philadelphia was making him play in the slot because he's skinny. That's something you see a lot, where it's like, oh, you got a light, skinny receiver, he's got to play the slot. He's not big enough to run block outside. So you either need to get over the fact that he's small and not maybe the ideal outside run blocker, or you just have to accept that your offense doesn't have a good role for him. Because if you make Nelson Agholor play in the slot, his bad hands are going to show up. He's going to get rattled going over the middle. He's going to get rocked because he's skinny. And that was happening with D.D. Westbrook a lot, too. He pretty clearly should be playing outside. So his ACL tear is going to make it a little harder for him. But if there was, like, a Nelson Agholor this year, I would say it's Westbrook. And if the Patriots don't handle it the right way, they could definitely make bad Agholor come back. You got to keep him outside, keep him playing downfield. And, you know, have him run crossing routes and stuff, sure. But that's more after you kind of establish the run threats that open up the middle of the field for him. Don't send him into traffic. You have to clear out the traffic first.
Right, exactly. Because like you said, bad Agholor can still exist if you use him the wrong way. So Vegas kind of maybe found the blueprint for how to do it. And, you know, I would assume the Patriots picked up on that. And, you know, that's why they went after him on day one of free agency. So overall, I mean, this again was an offense that was busted all of last year. What's your level of optimism on these moves and you know, where the Patriots could stand in the AFC East?
So they're shuffling their offensive line quite a bit, which I'm not a huge fan of. But what's weird is it's guys that they've had before. So it's like they're bringing Trent Brown back. They signed Ted Karras back from Miami. They already played last year without Marcus Cannon, so him getting traded, I guess, doesn't necessarily matter that much, even though he was a good player. But it's like they're letting the David Andrews guy walk. So there's a lot of shuffling going on the offensive line, and I like to see continuity on the offensive line instead. But if they already kind of know these guys, maybe it's not like starting from scratch, and maybe they can just get that offensive line polished for week one, no problem. But if they can, then I actually like quite a bit the theory of the Patriots offense, or at least what I can imagine the theory of it being, because when you have Cam Newton out there, you've got such a big athletic quarterback that it's kind of like, unless the defensive front seven you're going against is oversized, that's just kind of like a natural leverage starting point that you have over them. It's like the defense you're going against is built under the assumption that it's going against a quarterback who's between like 6'1 and 6'5 and 215 and 235 pounds. And they're not supposed to run the way Newton can. But when you got a 250 pounder who can run like Newton, it's kind of all of a sudden like the defense needs to reconsider its personnel just at that start point. It's like we can't put our 210 pound dime linebacker out there. We need to reconsider how we handle that. And it's almost like to me when you start with Cam as the foundation and then you add almost, I guess what I'm almost thinking of is like almost those old Georgia Tech offenses, but instead of having an all option quarterback, you have Cam, and instead of having two jet sweep backs, you have Dalton, you have Jonnu Smith and Hunter Henry, and maybe Dalton Keene eventually. And those two guys kind of function anywhere from running back to tight end to receiver, because that's the kind of athletes, that's the kind of versatility that they pose. And with Cam being the rushing threat that he is, you can leverage that into a certain like default approach from the defense. Like if you as a defense don't account for the Cam running threat, they can just take it until you do. And to account for it, you have to kind of tax yourself on maybe containing the outside run or some particular dive attack. And so you can kind of get Damian Harris, Sony Michel, Chris Carson, Leonard Fournette, whoever they end up with at running back. They can kind of be that John Dwyer just dive halfback who just goes in kamikaze every time he gets the ball. And Cam gets his carry shots in, of course. That all of this gets leveraged into play action looks to the tight ends who keep the defense a little bit off balance with some screens here and there. You use a lot of motion, a lot of deception, and you kind of make like a jumbo pistol offense that kind of bashes the defense a lot with this run kind of foundation that can turn into more of a passing attack. Just because these guys who are plus blockers are also dangerous as pass catchers, especially if you're trying to cover them with like smaller defenders. So there's ways that I think you can leverage the pieces of this New England offense into something pretty smart and difficult to anticipate, because with that kind of versatility in the personnel, it's just hard to know what you need to do as a defense. Like you can go out there thinking you have a good idea of what plays they're going to run, but if they come out there with just ambiguous personnel and they're kind of doing an amoeba offense, like all you really have is the down and distance to try to guess what they're doing. And if you guess wrong, they might get like three blockers with a running back with a three blocker advantage running on the weak side of your defense. And, you know, people like to say the run game doesn't matter, but if you give up plays like that, it'll mess with your head as a defense, and you won't know what plays you need to call to get it all fixed. You can conceal a lot, and you can cause like physically painful sorts of outcomes for the defense if they guess wrong. So
yeah, it reminds me like a little bit.
Oh, I was gonna say, it's almost like a little bit like a maybe like what the Chip Kelly offense could have been, like up tempo and aggressive, but run based and distinctly fast feeling, even though it's not airing it out.
Mm-hmm. And I could kind of also draw a little bit of a parallel potentially to like the 2019 Ravens. You know, that they're always using the two tight end sets. I mean, it wasn't quite the same. Lamar Jackson, different in terms of, you know, Cam Newton more like the physical imposing wear you down guy, Lamar Jackson more the elusive speed guy, but nonetheless, you know, similar kind of going counter to the way the rest of the league is going in which, you know, the team defenses are gearing up to stop the pass. And if you catch them on a week where they're going up against a run heavy team, they're not used to it.
It's a great money ball idea, I think, because it's like the whole league is building for a nickel defense base defense right now. Everyone's investing in a three wide base defense assumption. And if the Patriots come up to you and you have all this cap draft picks tied up in a good nickel corner, two outside corners kind of base defense, like those guys are just useless now, or at least one of those corners can't impact the game against the Patriots.
Yeah, so this suddenly becomes a very, very interesting team to watch. And, you know, Buffalo, you know, they obviously kind of ran away with the division a year ago, but, the Patriots have bowed up now. They made some defensive signings as well, Judon, Devin Godshaw. So, I mean, couple guys, and then, you know, you might get some of those opt-outs from a year ago that, you know, certainly stung. I don't know what the Gilmore situation is, but yeah, suddenly the Patriots, you know, definitely, you know, don't count them out just yet. And I like what the Dolphins are doing too. Or I like the directions of the Dolphins. I don't know if they've necessarily made any big
impact. It's not the old AFC East. It's a little different.
Yeah, so that's nice to see. And sticking in the AFC East, going over to a team the one team that we haven't gotten into just yet, the Jets. What did you make of their signing of Corey Davis?
I thought it was fine. I don't know what to make of Corey Davis's upside at this point. Like, it wouldn't be shocking if he was capable of quite a bit more than he did in Tennessee, because early in his Tennessee career, he kind of had injury troubles and Marcus Mariota struggled. And then once Ryan Tannehill got in there, A.J. Brown was there as the clearly superior player. But not being as good as the best receiver in the league isn't really, it's not something you can hold against a player, especially
right.
when he's been efficient in his own part. And, you know, again, the injuries, it's not fair to say that Corey Davis ever failed in Tennessee. It's just A.J. Brown showed up and then they didn't have enough money to spend to keep him. So he might be capable of being a legitimate wide receiver one for the Jets or other teams. I don't know. In the meantime, it's hard for me to get a sense of what to expect from that offense. Like, I have trouble figuring out what I expect that offense to look like. I don't believe the theories about Zach Wilson going second overall to the Jets. I think Zach Wilson will be the fourth quarterback taken. And I think the second pick is either going to be Justin Fields, maybe Trey Lance, maybe a Deshaun Watson trade. That's kind of how I'm looking at it at that spot. So that's like a range of things. That in each case, I can kind of start to figure out, or at least I get an idea of like what I think it'll look like. Not knowing which of those ahead of time, though, is more likely than the other makes it impossible, because Deshaun Watson is very different from Justin Fields, who's very different from Trey Lance. So I don't know where any of that's going. And I know it's supposed to be an ostensibly a Shanahan kind of offense with Mike LaFleur there, but I just don't know. I don't know if maybe Mike LaFleur has a slightly different ideas on the Shanahan offense and the McVay offenses than everybody else that we've seen implement them. Like, it's just hard for me to know for sure. And so I don't really see, obviously, the big volume scenario for Davis, but it might be there. And if it is, I don't really see any grounds to be particularly pessimistic about him. It's almost like his durability is my biggest concern.
Right, because, those injuries, especially early in his Titans career, kind of stifled things a little bit. But, you know, he had a really strong contract year this year, of course, and obviously ended up getting paid handsomely for it. You know, career highs and tied the career high in catches, yards, touchdowns, set a new career high and 10.7 yards per target. So really, really strong numbers across the board. So yeah, whatever the Jets quarterback situation ends up being, I think will kind of help dictate my level of interest in Corey Davis. How do you think he fits as far as the rest of this offense goes? And, you know, is there a receiver that is hurt by this in this offense? Does this, you know, kind of push Denzel Mims's value down a little bit in the long term? What's up with Breshad Perriman, stuff like that?
Well, Perriman's a free agent. I don't know whether they have any interest in re-signing him. I would guess they probably don't, but maybe they do. As long as they don't sign Perriman or somebody else, Mims should be fine. Like, there wasn't a realistic shot at Mims being their clear wide receiver one or anything. So if he isn't their clear wide receiver one, to me, that's not really obvious grounds for downgrading him. For me, it'd be more like, if we're worried about Denzel Mims getting 800 snaps, then I start to worry about him. But Corey Davis doesn't change that. It was rumored that they were looking at maybe moving Jamison Crowder, who plays in the slot. Of course, he only plays in the slot. So that wouldn't specifically boost Mims's snap count, but it would be reassuring for his target share potential, just because Crowder gets hurt a lot and he's not like dominant or anything, but he is a good player at running routes underneath and he gets a lot of targets. So if they move Crowder, whoever they replace him with is not likely, or at least I would guess they're not likely to draw targets quite as much as Crowder did. So that would probably be good for both Mims and Davis if he were traded.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine that they're going to be as reliant on the slot this year, with better quarterback situation, just better overall situation in general. Getting Adam Gase out of there, I think, is going to just be a huge boon for this team in general. You know, one other just kind of observation, we'll see what comes of this, but maybe this connects a couple of dots. But do you see the Jets, because looking at their current running back depth chart, it's pretty bleak. We've seen a couple, you know, good NFL running backs get released in recent days. Do you think that a guy like Damian Williams could potentially be a fit for the Jets?
Maybe. I mean, Damian Williams is a 220-pound guy who catches the ball really well and is fast, but the fact that he never broke out before playing for the Chiefs might indicate that he lacks vision, and so he might need space manufactured for him. But if he has the space manufactured for him, I think he can capitalize on it about as well as pretty much anybody. But yeah, both with Miami and at Oklahoma in college, he never was that explosive of a runner, like not as explosive as you would expect someone as strong and fast as him to be. But yeah, he can run, he can still move, and maybe this offense will be competent. Like, maybe Mike LaFleur will be as good as Matt LaFleur and the McVay coaching tree and the Shanahans. And if so, then yeah, pretty much any running back would kind of have an easy task in that case. But in the meantime, I have no sense for what they plan to do with their backfield. I guess they could be going after one of Najee Harris or Travis Etienne in the draft. So that's a pretty big possibility, I guess. In the meantime, I would say Ty Johnson is their best running back, because Michael Pirine I don't think is very good. And Ty Johnson looks like he's kind of bad as a pass catcher, though, is the thing. So, which is weird because he's such a fast guy, but he's been just not effective as a pass catcher and pretty good as a runner. So as Philip Lindsay and his like cold reception from the Broncos showed, being a speed back without a proven passing down skill set is a good way to get just pushed aside. So I don't know what, as far as in-house options, makes much sense for them. But P. Ryan to me is just like, just some guy who's going to ride the baseline at best.
Yeah, replacement level type of guy. Let's get on over. Got a couple of weird quarterback signings, but, you know, notable ones nonetheless. Let's start things off. Ryan Fitzpatrick to the Washington football team. Did you see that coming at all? I mean, I guess we had to figure that there was going to be some sort of added competition for Heinicke, but I'm not sure that I'm slam dunk thinking that Fitzpatrick wins that job over Heinicke, unless there's, you know, some kind of political organizational motive, more specifically, right, to just have Fitzpatrick be the starter. But I thought Heinicke did well enough in that playoff game to warrant it. But I knew that he needed some extra competition. Fitzpatrick just kind of, adds drama wherever he goes, basically. So I mean, what's going on here?
Well, he's definitely more favorable for fantasy purposes than someone like Kyle Allen or Alex Smith. Like, that's, to me, the only tangible takeaway. I've seen a lot of people who apparently have spent too much time on the internet or something, and they forgot that the Ryan Fitzpatrick being epic thing is supposed to be a joke. It's not that serious. But now we have this thing where Ryan Fitzpatrick signs with Washington, and you got all these people going like, oh, man, it's on now. He's so good. Oh, man. Terry McLaurin's going to really go Megatron finally now that he has Ryan Fitzpatrick throwing the ball to him. So that's embarrassing. He sucks. Like, it's fine. He's the best they can do, and good for him being an old quarterback, making it work. Ryan Fitzpatrick has been a bad quarterback his entire career. He admittedly did have probably his best 10 games or whatever last year.
Yeah.
But he, like, I'm sorry, 10 games just can't really matter that much to me when I've got, what, 13 years of him being just bad before that.
Yeah, the other shoe's going to drop eventually. Like, it was always like clockwork that he would turn into a pumpkin. Like, at
yeah, and
point.
He has a backbreaking turnover tendency, and everyone knows that, or everyone once knew that his gunslinger chucking it thing was the direct trade-off, the direct trade-off of him just gunslinging like that was that he throws all these interceptions, and people just seem to think now that, oh, he's actually just a bomber. He's got a clean game. He makes sick downfield throws because he's so epic. And it's not the case. It's like he throws downfield because he has to. Like, he's a short quarterback who doesn't have a cannon arm, and it's kind of like the Russell Wilson thing where it's like he doesn't really make plays in the intermediate that well because it's not an advantageous leverage point for him standing where he does, being built like he is, the throwing angles that he makes. He can't really attack the inner part of the field as easily as he can the downfield part. And it's not for a lack of accuracy. It's just the ball needs to go without getting caught and knocked over by people, you know?
Yep.
And so his intermediate game has always been bad. His accuracy has always been hit or miss at best. And when things go right for him, it's basically because the ball bounced the right way. So he's almost like a knuckleballer quarterback or something. Like, it's just, yeah, you can maybe luck into an insane season with R.A. Dickey or whatever, but you don't think that he's an ace pitcher. And that's kind of what a lot of people are failing to realize about with Fitzpatrick. They're like, he's infallible. It's going to be sick. Now Logan Thomas is a beast, everyone's saying. It's embarrassing. People have no perspective about this stuff. I don't really understand why it's so hard to just settle down for a minute. But Ryan Fitzpatrick is at once maybe the best that Washington could do, and he's still not a good quarterback. Taylor Heinicke is probably better than him, but Taylor Heinicke gets hurt all the time. Like, he got hurt. I feel like he got hurt in that game or something, didn't he? But either way, his first game as a starting over Kyle Allen for the Panthers 3 years ago or whatever, he dislocated his left elbow like right away. So Heinicke's just wild, and by most accounts, he's kind of a goofy guy. So I know why they wouldn't want to go in with him. But if he doesn't destroy himself in practice, he's way faster than Fitzpatrick. He's got a stronger arms by far. He's not any shorter, I don't think. Or maybe he's a little bit shorter, I don't know. But Fitzpatrick, in any case, the guy's got trash numbers for his career. And, yeah, in Buffalo, he didn't have much help. But with the Jets, he was throwing to Brandon Marshall and Eric Decker. And with the Buccaneers, he's throwing to Mike Evans and Chris Godwin. I know that he didn't have a great situation with the Dolphins last year, but he's not a player whose past failures can be explained by circumstances, and he still is more or less that same guy.
Yeah, there's a reason why no one ever commits to him in any long-term sense. Again, like you said, he did have that notable stretch last season. You know, everyone remembers the game in December. Dolphins kind of had to have it. They benched Tua out in Vegas. Fitzpatrick leads the comeback, that sort of thing. So that kind of anecdotal stuff can get stuck in your craw or stuck in your brain and kind of make you lose the perspective that you need to be having, like you were just mentioning there, with the more longer term view of who Ryan Fitzpatrick really is. And, you know, I almost think that, like, because he didn't really have that, like, really, really harsh regression a year ago, that it's going to, like, come, like, twofold this year. So
His BABIP is up at, like, 475 or something, and it's not a good bet to assume he'll keep that same – those relatively clean numbers from last year. I would expect to come crashing down. But it is admittedly good for Terry McLaurin – maybe not relative to Heinicke, but definitely relative to Alex Smith and Kyle Allen. Those two are useless and really bad for receivers. I would say Fitzpatrick is bad for Logan Thomas for that reason, because Logan Thomas isn't actually good. He was just like the fourth best PPR tight end in a year where tight ends were terrible, and now people think he's good. He's not. He's okay, good for him, but he's the kind of player who's the best player you have when your team is terrible. And the second that you stop being one of the worst offenses in the league, that guy's a backup.
There we go. I got nothing to add there. Let's get on over the other kind of big signing with the huge internet reaction from this free agent period. That of course would be, what are the Bears going to do? And what did the Bears do?
Apparently tried to trade for Russell Wilson. They tried to trade apparently 3 first-round picks, a third, and 2 starters for Russell Wilson, which the Seahawks evidently declined. I don't have any clue. Like, I haven't seen anything as far as saying the Bears went after Deshaun Watson to that extent, so maybe they're like afraid of him. Maybe he owned them too many times on Twitter, and then they were like, Russell Wilson hasn't posted about us, so he's an option. But if we don't get him, it's going to be the red rifle that we bring in. And they brought in Andy Dalton on a 1-year, $10 million deal, which may or may not be enough to keep him in the starting role. It makes him like the heavy favorite right now, and there's not any obvious reason why the Bears would come out of the draft with something especially pressing at quarterback. So it's probably going to be Dalton, and I don't know. I don't know what's going on with Allen Robinson. I would not want to play there if I was him. I think it's well within Allen Robinson's rights to say, I'm not playing for the Bears. If he did say that, then Andy Dalton's situation goes from, maybe okay for fantasy purposes to probably more like, this is really going to be a bummer kind of thing. So for Dalton. So that would be pretty dreary, the idea of, like, I like Darnell Mooney as a prospect, but if he's your wide receiver 1 and, like, Cole Kmet's your wide receiver 2 and your quarterback's Andy Dalton, like, it's probably just really depressing around.
Yeah, there. I mean, Dalton didn't look great with one of the best pass-catching groups in the league last year. And Chicago also does not have a good offensive line. Not that the Cowboys did necessarily either, but, you know, that – his situation in that sense, his time to throw isn't going to get any better. And, you know, like we established, the options are decidedly worse, especially pending the Allen Robinson decision, whether he's going to play under the tag or not, or end up getting traded. So, yeah, this is, you know, for a Chicago team that, you know, felt like it was really building something in 2018, feels like that window is pretty closed.
Yeah, it's going to be really bad. It's not going to be good. Like, David Montgomery had his maybe career year last year. It's like, he's going to suffer for Andy Dalton. Well, he won't necessarily suffer for Andy Dalton being there, but his numbers were going to come down. Like, the only way Montgomery's production was going to stay stable was if they improved the offense and made his job easier and made the pie bigger for everybody. And that's all off the table.
Sure is. So yeah, not great. I would be, if I was a Chicago fan, I would not be particularly stoked with, I mean, maybe I wouldn't have, you know, gotten my hopes up and thought it was realistic that Russell Wilson was a possibility, but still, no matter what, ending up with Dalton at the end of this just doesn't feel particularly encouraging. I probably think that Mitchell Trubisky is a better quarterback than current day Andy Dalton. I don't know if that's a hot take.
He's a better running back, and that's your best option. Like, if your choices are Andy Dalton and Mitch Trubisky playing quarterback, I don't really know. But if you have those two choices, the right option is to take Trubisky and forego the quarterback position entirely.
Yep. Then really fire up the Georgia Tech offense. All right, let's get on over to a couple of the running back signings. I'm going to kind of just tee you up here because I saw some of the reaction on Twitter to some of these signings and what they mean for a couple of these second year running backs. All right, so I'll let you go or take your pick. Do you want to go with the Hyde to Jacksonville signing or the Jamal Williams to Detroit signing and what those mean for James Robinson and DeAndre Swift?
Yeah, so I might just be a dupe, like falling for cynical media practices and making too much out of something that's just race to the bottom type content where every time a running back signs with a team where there's already a running back, that running back that's already there is over, man. If some team signs a second running back, that starter is never playing again.
Nah.
And as we know, every good running back in fantasy football is the only running back on his team. So if a team signs a running back, it's just done. Pull the plug. There's no hope.
And also, the older, more washed up running back is always better than the one on his rookie contract. Always.
Yeah, because if you sign a running back, then the running backs that are already on the team are never going to play again and are bad. And probably you should hate them. But, yeah, so Carlos Hyde, who sucks, and already played – he played with Jacksonville for, like, 7 games that Nick Chubb rookie year, and he had 3.3 yards per carry after they traded a 5th-round pick for him. And then what has he done since other than have, like, 4 good runs as a bench player for the Seahawks? So – and then he got hurt. So Carlos Hyde is this guy who – he's pretty fast for how big he is, and he runs hard. Like, he's not a fun person to tackle, but his vision has never been good because he doesn't find the open field. Despite all of his ability to break tackles and run away from people, he just gets caught all the time. And as a pass catcher, his negative elusiveness really shows up because he's actually got pretty good hands. Like, he catches passes that go to him, but for his career, and it's been the case in every team that he's played for, it's insane. I've never seen anything like it. He's averaging like 3.8, 4 yards a target or something while catching like 80% of the targets. I've never seen anything like that. So you can't really do anything with Carlos Hyde other than have him play like dive halfback, which is fine. And for Jacksonville to sign him for that purpose makes totally a lot of sense. If Robinson needs a breather, or if Robinson just, you know, gets 3 carries on a drive and they have a 3rd and short and they need someone to run at 110% straight at the first down marker who's you know, going to hurt somebody who tries to tackle him before he gets there, Carlos Hyde can do that. But if you want to run the entire offense, it's not going. Like, he can only do a certain number of plays, and none of which are really passing situation ones, which is as much as I hate the PPR mania of the day and specifically the ideologies that spring forth from PPR economic incentives, I think it's pretty significant that James Robinson never left the field in passing downs last year. Like, people talk about, like, oh my God, he got 80% of their carries. That's never happened. That doesn't happen ever. Like, it also doesn't mean anything because they had the fewest carries in the league. They had like 337 carries as a team last year. Mm-hmm. James Robinson can afford to get 70% of the carries or whatever less than last year and still come out with more carries because they're not going to suck as much. They're going to run the ball more because they won't be losing as of 10 minutes into every single game like they did last year. So, yeah, his share of carries is going to go down, but the team carry count is going to go up. And in the meantime, they haven't added anyone who can project for passing down functions. Now, I expect them to add another running back either through the draft or maybe in free agency yet, or maybe they'll just sign Curtis Samuel and they'll say that's close enough. But that's what we're looking at the moment. This idea that Carlos Hyde is going to just kick aside James Robinson as a pure runner has no basis. And the idea that he's going to take any passing down work is just wrong. It's stupid. So I know most people didn't freak out too much about the James Robinson thing. Some people did. And I might be dumb for thinking they were sincere because it pretty much – is incredible that someone would actually believe that. It's also incredible to me that anyone would think Jamal Williams is a threat to DeAndre Swift. But it makes a little more sense because at least Jamal Williams can play passing down stuff. Like,
right,
he can pass block, and if you throw him the ball, he generally will catch it. But I also think that Jamal Williams was the best case scenario for DeAndre Swift because them signing Jamal Williams means knock on wood anyway, means they're not signing a Chris Carson or even a Philip Lindsay or something. Like somebody – there are a bunch of players who are much more threatening from scrimmage than Jamal Williams, and the Lions did not sign them. They signed him, who is a threat to precisely – I guess in addition to pass blocking stuff, Jamal Williams could get like short yardage work just because of the reasoning of like, oh, well, he runs so hard. He's such a bruiser or whatever. I think if they take that approach, it will fail. Like, he can't run. He's not good with the ball. He doesn't make big plays. He breaks some tackles, and people really stick to the optics of Jamal Williams. Like, they really stick to the optics of him running real hard on the field and trying real hard. And
well, he's got the taped fingers instead of the gloves.
He does the cool thing, and everyone agrees he's a great deal of fun. And that's fine. I'm glad that he's doing well as a running back. Like, I'm glad he got paid a little bit. But he's a bad running back. He's terrible from scrimmage. There are not five worse running backs on an NFL roster who are worse from scrimmage than Jamal Williams. Look at his career. No explosiveness. He's right at like 3.8 yards per carry his whole career. He catches
the
ball.
140 yard run his entire career on 500 rushes.
Yeah, Jamal Williams does two things. He never fumbles, and he can pass block, and he can catch the ball. But even insofar as his pass catching usage goes, it's ill conceived because he's so unthreatening with the ball that the fact that he's catching the ball doesn't actually help. It's kind of like a less severe version of the Carlos Hyde deal. It's like Carlos Hyde can catch the ball too. He is perfect at going nowhere with it afterwards, so it doesn't matter that he's catching it. Something like that is true about Jamal Williams too. And Detroit, I think, will find that out. Now, maybe they don't think it's true right away. Maybe DeAndre Swift does get three or four goal line touchdowns poached by Jamal Williams. But when the time comes for them to need a competitive play from Jamal Williams, and if they pass up DeAndre Swift on that play for Jamal Williams, they're not getting the first down. They're not getting the touchdown. And if they keep doing it, that's how a coach's seat suddenly gets hot.
Well, we'll be optimistic on our Dan Campbell, and we'll trust him to do the right thing. So, I mean, I think Williams is a totally fine backup or RB2, but I think that they know with what they spent on DeAndre Swift and what they got out of him, especially down the stretch last year, that it'd be foolish to really, you know, do anything but, you know, take the restrictor plate off and just let Swift do his thing.
Yeah, Dan Campbell has been saying from the start he's thinking Alvin Kamara for DeAndre Swift. And I thought DeAndre Swift was underrated to start with in the redraft, 2021 redraft. And if his market actually suffers for this, that would be insane. And it would pretty much make Swift my number one target for the time being. Like, I would feel compelled to go sign up for drafts to get DeAndre Swift shares if his price goes down over something as stupid as this. Because to me, he should be, with the Saints offense being basically a question mark at this point, I don't really see a good basis for having Alvin Kamara so far ahead of Swift. Definitely not far ahead of Eckler. So those three guys are the same category of running back to me. It's like, we know they're not getting 300 carries. We know that they're not going to get a lot of, well, I guess Alvin Kamara's case, he got a lot of rushing touchdowns, but it wasn't so much specifically like a goal line emphasis. It was like he just scored a lot because the Saints scored
a lot.
He's
awesome, yeah.
Yeah, and he's really good. But the idea that that's a guarantee to keep happening with the Breeze offense gone and the Winston Hill offense arrived – seems a little hasty to me, and I say that as someone who thinks Jared Goff is terrible. Like, I don't think the Detroit offense is going to be good, but I don't think it needs to be good. In PPR, anyway, I don't think it needs to be good for Swift to clearly be, like, a top 15 pick. Like, his usage is almost the same as theirs. Like, I don't understand what the PPR argument is against Swift. It just doesn't go anywhere.
Nope. So if he starts falling outside of the top 15, and, you know, we'll definitely check back in on the it's going to be really interesting next week to check back in on ADPs come next week because, yeah, if your theory is correct and Swift's ADP suffers for this somehow, then yeah.
It might not. I can't tell if anyone's serious about this anymore, you know? It's like Jamal Williams runs hard, which he has to do because he has to run at 110% to be 85% as good as any other running back, and that's not a threatening category of player to Swift.
Nope. I don't think so either, so I think that some good laying down of the law there. I think that's going to do it for this edition of the Free Agency Frenzy. We'll drop part two a little bit later in the week. But for Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.